Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Trench Tips. A bit of uncharted territory for me today. So I'm without my esteemed colleague, Mr. Jack Frimston. He is sunning himself on holiday, having a well-deserved rest from being someone who has something wrong with him. I'm told by his partner that the test results aren't back, but it's not looking good. So a little sip of the old brew there. So what I did this week was I went out to the school community, went over old LinkedIn messages, and went over YouTube comments, and compiled a list of questions that were frequently asked, and thought I would jump into helping answer some of those, seeing if this is something that's going to be useful in the future. So there's quite a mix. There's questions on business, there's questions on life, there's questions on sales, of course. So I'm going to jump in and have a little chat with you about all of them. So the first question I got was around email objections. So I think the premise of the question was something along the lines of, how do I get around an email objection? The people I'm speaking to are really interested, but they need to see an email first. So the first thing to note here is all sales advice exists in context, right? So I wish I could give you a prescribed, here is the ultimate silver bullet to handle any email objection. Unfortunately, I can't do that because I don't know the context of the conversation. But what I can do, it's a eureka moment because I can give you something. I can give you things to think about when you're looking to handle said objections. So the first thing to note is, it all depends on when the email has come up, and also probably somewhat depends on the personality type you're dealing with as well. So let's first look at the start of the call. Okay. So at the start of the call, let's say you've got through your value prop. So you've done your three problems or whatever your intro is, whatever your methodology is that you've used. Actually, not much has been said, but they've said, yeah, just send me an email. So this is a really direct, easy one. All we're going to do is just test that. Is that a knee-jerk response? And one thing to think about here is, if I approach you in the street completely out of the blue and started trying to pitch you or get you involved in a sales conversation, cortisol levels are going to raise a little bit and your body's going to enter a very mild fight or flight mode. I say very mild because I've not got a knife out, I'm not threatening you, but it still will activate a similar response. And while someone's in that response, they might be looking for distance, safety, just a moment to actually, I'm not interested. And the brain takes these funny little shortcuts. We think of them as biases, but it takes these little shortcuts just to keep us safe. So bang, moves into, I'm just not interested, or actually another version of that, send me an email. So how we're going to deal with this is, first thing with any objection is to welcome it. So anything you hear, any objection, any off-kilter, out-of-the-blue question, is always the first step is to welcome. So what does that actually sound like? So they say, yeah, could you send me an email actually in the first instance? It's to info at whatever it may be. Yeah, of course I can. No problem at all. That's what welcoming is going to sound like. Yeah, I can send you over an email first. Next, we're going to go for a permission to ask a follow-up question. Could I ask you a question just before I fire that email over? Yes, of course you can. Well, 9 times out of 10, when someone says, send me an email at this point of the call, what do you think they're really trying to tell me? Now, the key thing with this is the tone, the delivery. What you don't want to do is be the biggest dick in the world about it, because like I say, someone's already in fight or flight mode. Emotional responses are great, but perhaps done a bit early on in the call in this area, you might get a hang up. And I'm not saying getting someone emotional at the start of the call isn't a good idea in some regards. I'm just saying across, let's say, 100 conversations, you want to go for what's got the highest likelihood of getting you in a conversation, potentially circling you back to a problem. Okay, So that's the first one. Nice and early on in the call, that's the way you want to handle that. Now, the second one is, let's say you're further down the conversation, you're having a chat, they're opening up, you haven't really got to a problem yet, or it's not substantial enough a problem, and they just, oh, actually, could you fire me over an email? Something's twigged, and they've thought, I'm in a sales call, something's happened here. Yeah, get me out, hit the eject button, send me an email. Okay, fine. So what we're going to do here is we're going to employ a technique called looping. But the first step is always the same. The first step is I'm going to welcome the objection. Absolutely. Of course I can. I can send you that email. And actually, to get a bit of space here, I always recommend, even if you got it, can I just grab your email? I'm not going to jot that down. A little bit of space. Do you mind if I ask something but before I fire this over, just to make sure it's relevant? Again, permission. Yes, of course you can. Well, out of the problems I mentioned at the start of the call, and then give little short options, getting in front of more people, getting in front of enough people, perhaps breaking into a new area or sector, which one would you say most stood out to you? They're going to give you one of those problems. Now, it's important here to not outstay your welcome. So I would always recommend using something like a labeling style technique. The human brain can only take so many what or how questions before it feels like it's being interrogated. So what we're going to go for is it sounds like there's a particular reason that you picked enough people. Yeah, because we're da-da-da-da-da. And then before you know it, you're into a qualifying type conversation. We find on average when we look at the CRM and when we analyze the data, two or three questions once you've removed yourself from the email coming up there, you're actually back into a qualifying conversation anyway. Tends to be a nice way of circling back to having that conversation. So the looping technique there, welcome, permission, and then a question that loops you back to multiple choice out of A, B, and C, which one most applies to you, and then back into qualifying. So those are those two. Now, I do think it's important to mention that sometimes you will deal with certain personality types. Our operations director, Ben, is a similar kind of guy. You just probably aren't going to book him on a call. He needs to see something. He's an analyst. He wants to make sure that he's got some sort of written proof or something to digest first before agreeing to something. So you might actually ask all these questions, get a bit more meat on the bone, but they still need to see that email. Fine. So what you then want to do is highlight some next steps. And I simply say, okay, I'll fire this over. And you know what? I'm a little bit of a sucker for a next step. So what would you like to do after that? I'm giving it to the prospect to pick. I'm not doing that pushy thing of like, well, I'll call you back on Friday at 3:00. They'll probably say, okay, give me X amount of time to digest it and then give me a call back. When they say that, I would say, well, look, you're busy, I'm busy. I tell you what I'll do. I'll pop something in the diary that I'm going to give you a call. And if you read the email or you spot that I'm going to call you and you think, actually, I'm not interested, I read something I didn't like, you can just email me the word no back. Does that sound fair? And that way, you've got these diarized follow-ups in your diary. We both know when you're going to call because you'll probably all have experienced that thing of, I'm going to call you back on Friday. No matter what time you rang, it's always the wrong time. So having something diarized, you can imagine all the different benefits that has, prompts them to relook at the email. They know you're going to call. Nothing's a surprise. So these types of things are really good habits to get into. The other scenario here is they might say, well, I'll get back to you once I've looked at this. And again, that goes back to my initial point of 9 times out of 10, when that happens, I'm very unlikely to hear from you again. I can take rejection. I suppose give me a rough estimate. Out of 10, how likely do you think I am, based on this conversation, to ever hear from you again? Tone is everything. Try not to deliver things like a wanker. Okay, so that's email objections. How do I discover my why? This is a really interesting question. I'm actually quite honored that someone would ask me a question like this. I'm just a telephone monkey after all. So how do I discover my why? It's a really good question. What I would advise with things like this is you want to play little thought experiment games with yourself. So a thought experiment around how to find your why could be the rocking chair test. So that is, if you imagine yourself at 80 years old, you've had a fortunately long life, but the majority of your life is in the rearview mirror. You want to ask yourself the question of, looking back to this moment right now, what would you wish you did with your life? How would you wish you'd spent this chapter of your life? And the key thing is, this needs to be a conversation with you internally, not shared with other people. Because what can happen, we're all guilty of it, and often it's happening unconsciously because of habits or beliefs, whatever it may be. But you can do signaling. So you can say things that you actually don't mean. Oh, I'd really like to be living in a big house and be a millionaire. And you give kind of vacuous answers like that. But often what happens is you might say, well, I hope I've made a difference, or I hope I've made X person proud. And you just want to go down the rabbit hole with, why is that important? How do you make those things happen? But key, and the main one, is, why is that important? The other question to ask yourself, very simple one when you're doing this exercise, is whenever you say something back to yourself, just simply sense check it. Is this true? Is what I'm saying true? It's a really good way of just sense checking everything that you say. Now, that would be on kind of a big macro level, right? So that is, what am I doing? What's my purpose? How do I find my purpose? If I was making a promise to my older self, what would that promise be? How would I keep it? Now, let's say then we're looking at more the micro level of finding your why as a salesperson. I'll say salesperson. I think it's easier than talking about business person, but let's say salesperson, okay? So finding my why as a salesperson, there's some neuroscience here that works against you. One said thing is, we have hunter-gatherer-based wiring when it comes to selling and providing, that has a dopamine response, right? So I hunt, I gather, I get a dopamine response that's basically just a reward signal to my body. It lets a little chemical out called dopamine that tells my body, you have successfully completed the reward, now you feel good. Now, the issue with selling as a career is, my goals can be quite material goals. So because of that, I have these big peaks and troughs in my performance. So what could happen is, my goal might be, I'm trying very hard to pay for a very nice holiday, watch, house, whatever it may be. It'll be something where it's a actual thing. The issue is, that thing has a finish line. Okay, so what could happen is, I work really hard. I then get the car. I buy the car. I get that hunter-gatherer dopamine response. You've ticked the box, you have the thing, and then I have this big trough in performance while I try and find the next thing. So actually, your goal has these little finish lines. Typically, this is quite common when you're first starting out in sales, that you have these things and these drivers. You tick them, big trough in performance, bit of pressure again. Okay, now I've got a new goal, peak, trough. It can go like that. But often you can find something else, that actually those things that you're acquiring don't actually always bring you happiness. I'm not saying money doesn't bring you happiness, because I actually think if you have money, you're able to solve the more intrinsic problems in your life and find inner peace and all those sorts of things. So I think money allows you to be able to focus on the next level of goals and needs. But what I am saying is, sometimes happiness isn't where you think it is. So what's the answer? Well, for salespeople, you might want to instead be focused on things that don't have a finish line. So that could be things like, how do I conduct the perfect sales process? How do I have the perfect sales call? But it might just be, how do I master the skill set? Or, how do I document my journey so that I help other salespeople along theirs? But it has to be something that doesn't really have a strict finish line. How do I learn as much about sales as possible so I get myself to a position where I'm comfortable enough to start my own business? These things don't necessarily have a finish line, but they can move on to other things quite organically. So it's less start, stop. It's more of a constant. So I would argue that actually this is probably an easier driver to follow than perhaps some of the other things. So the macro thing, big long answer to this, I do apologize. Big answer here. How do I discover my why? Is going to be rocking chair tests, looking back on your life in the future, promises made, what do you hope you've done? All those sorts of big picture questions. But the micro level around being a salesperson that's consistent is going to be looking at a goal that doesn't necessarily have a finish line, but it's got more gradual steps to getting better. How do I master sales as a skill set? How do I get myself to a position where, regardless of personality, sector, objection, question, I'm comfortable in any scenario? How do I become the black belt of selling? So I hope that helps. Right, the next one, this was actually the same handsome young man who asked me this question, the accountability question. So how do I keep myself accountable? I think this was without guilting myself into it, which is interesting. A little sip there. Right, so accountability without guilting myself into it. Yeah, you want to be careful with guilting yourself into things. Sales is a career where you don't necessarily get burnout, but it is possible to get emotional burnout. And emotional burnout is that inability to regulate one's emotions. So if you're guilting yourself into things, you're actually inviting that into your life. So don't do that. Okay. This might go back to something that I said before. If you could look back at the way you spent your life now, given that why that you've discovered and what you're working towards, would you say that you've worked towards it, you've stayed the same, or you've gone backwards? That's quite an important thing to ask yourself. The other thing is, if you could broadcast your day out to, I don't know, a community that you think highly of, an individual that you think highly of, would they think you'd done a good day's work? So that's, it's hard, isn't it? Because that is, in a way, that is guilting yourself into it. But if we're looking for something that's more logic-based, what you probably want to do is work backwards as a salesperson and just have some concrete numbers. And concrete numbers, let's say they are working back from, for every deal closed, how many proposals do I need to put out there? For every proposal that I put out there, how many discovery calls do I need to have? For every discovery call I have, how many net new cold conversations do I need to have? For all the net new conversations that I have, how many lists, dials, whatever it may be, do I need to build? And that way you can keep yourself quite honest. I always found when I was starting this business, two meetings, because it was just me, was plenty. So when I'd book two meetings, I would move on to something else. In month one, I had 40 meetings booked. I obviously couldn't work with 40 people, but it allowed me some choice around those things. So accountability is an interesting one. I would think if you discover your why, that will allow you to find the accountability to pursue it. So you have that motivation regardless anyway. I only got good at keeping myself accountable and not struggling to find motivation when I found out I was having children. I wouldn't say you have to have children to find these things, but also if you're struggling to find it, probably the question to ask yourself is why. Not everyone should be in sales. Your brain, the universe, whatever it may be, your ancestors, whoever's interfering here, has a funny way of, if you feel like you're on the wrong path, listen to those signs. You might be being told you're on the wrong path if you can't answer those things through what I've just said. Okay, hope that helps. Next up, we've got opening a meeting. How do you kick off a sales meeting? This is a big, broad, open question. So the formula I follow is, we jump onto the call. I'm not amazing at small talk. I will try it sometimes. Jack is much better than me at building relationships and things. I'm not the popular one. I've come to terms with that as time's gone on. So I normally say, look, we've only got half an hour in the diary. Do you mind if we jump straight in? Of course, no problem. So the first thing is, I want to get expectations from the prospect. Someone's favorite subject is always themselves. We should start off with that in mind. So the first question I ask is, what needs to happen on this call to make it a good use of your time? Other ways of saying that is, normally when I speak to people, they have a tick list of things that they need to find out on this call. What does said tick list look like for you? And then I found out expectations on the call. Often it might be generic things like budget, what you do. There might be things like that, but really what tends to happen is people paint a bit of a picture of why they're there, where they've come from, what they're looking to find out. They will give you some nice meat on the bone. I jot all those things down to come back to later. And I say, okay, well, look, I like to keep these conversations as ethical as possible. I'm just going to give you all the bad news up front, all the reasons why people don't work with us. If you hear anything in here that you don't like, any red flags, you get half an hour back in your diary because I can take rejection and you look like someone who's comfortable telling me no. Big smile, laugh, ha, ha, yes, of course. And then I lay out, in my world, it's typically a commitment and the commercial model of the business. So I run over commitment, commercial model of the business. The last point I usually mention is I tend to have to ask quite a few tough questions as part of this conversation. So those are the three. Commitment, commercials, I tend to have to ask tough questions. You might think I'm a bit of a dick as a result. Now, when I've done that, I would then, if I've not done it already, go over some form of mini commitment type thing, upfront contract. So I'd say, okay, well, if we get to the end of the conversation, you've explored the things we talked about before, you're not interested, are you comfortable telling me no? Yes, I'm comfortable telling you no. If you're not and you like what you hear, are we comfortable outlining some next steps? Yes, typically, what do those next steps look like? Now, I'll be really honest, I don't always do that. I don't always do that because what can often happen is what you want to happen at the end of the call or what do you want to happen during this call, they can tick that box during that question. So if that happens, I don't then ask that again because it can look like you're not listening and you're following quite a prescribed formula. So that's it. And then the first question I kick off with is, okay, well, look, set the scene for me. Give me as much meat on the bone as possible. Tell me why we're here. And then they normally set the scene for me. I'm then in my world looking for who you're trying to get in front of, what problem they need to have to make it a worthwhile conversation. But you don't need to know that. So that's how I kick off a discovery call. I hope that's been helpful. Okay. The next question around managing tasks and projects. Big, broad question. Not always sure how to answer that outside of context. Okay, so a few different ways I can think of this. So when I first started the business, the way I would approach tasks is I would not allow myself to put anything in the diary that was non-revenue driving. So my day was quite disciplined in terms of net new conversations I was having were always at a certain time period. I'd usually put that in for a couple of hours. I'd only allow myself discovery calls in certain blocks. But there was never anything that wasn't non-revenue driving in there. So this is good if you're a business owner who's also doing the new biz because you're bootstrap startup or whatever it may be. So non-revenue driving tasks aren't allowed in. And what do they look like? Well, they look like branding or video content like this. I would just focus purely on the revenue driving tasks. Now that we've moved forward a bit, there's a few different ways that we manage tasks. We've got a big system integration piece that we've done with Salesforce. So projects are all managed on there via things that are much cleverer than me. But then we also use Teams quite extensively. So Teams is there to shout out what's happening for certain campaigns. And then also for operations things, there's folders in there. Some of our clients make us Teams folders as well, just to monitor how tasks are running. And there's regular catch-ups around tasks and projects that we're looking on. So I hope that one has been helpful. Okay, what have we got next? Okay, last thing. Who's been the most influential person on me in terms of sales methodology. There's a few different people, actually. I mean, I'll give a few different shout outs. I think the connection that everyone knows is I'm a big fan and fortunate enough to say a friend of the great Benjamin Dennehy. I remember when I was sat in my bedroom working for another business, I listened to him talking to Mike Winnett, and the conversation was around, if you're a salesperson who can do the job without someone looking over your shoulder and you're delivering consistent results, you probably shouldn't have a boss. And I thought, wow, that's really interesting, because at the time I was working for a business where I was one of the only people that was making that business any money. And I was getting still quite a hard time from them, because I'm sure it's very stressful to run a business during that part of the pandemic. So I can empathize. But it certainly sparked a fire in me. I really like Ben's methodology, the way he looks at selling. And I think it's not too pithy. You know, it's not got that thing around sales being a force for good, which I think is important. You know, I do definitely believe that, but I don't think that's necessarily super helpful for people who are just starting out on their sales journeys. You can come back and get philanthropic about it later, but just in terms of actionable takeaways, Benjamin was a great help for me. I've also looked at other people who don't exist in the sales world. So I'm interested in therapists. I love listening to really interesting podcasts. So I like people like Lex Fridman, Louis Theroux. I really like the way they pose questions, give lots of room, and then the way they proactively listen to connect the dots. I think, unfortunately, at school, we're not taught about communication and the way conversation is typically constructed. And if you're not someone who wants to read lots of books on that, you could just listen to people on podcasts who are doing it really well. How do they pose difficult questions? How do they ask follow-ups? How do they use that to examine rebuttal? How do they get the most out of guests? So that's really useful. And then, yeah, lots of different therapy techniques are important. The other unsung hero in my sales career is the best boss I ever had is a guy called Luke Dash. He's now the CEO of a company called ISMS. Luke was really great, because when I came to work for Luke, I'd had experience, but I was a bit of an unpolished sales tool. I had things. I was a bit arrogant and not afraid to do certain things, but I certainly wasn't slick and didn't know that many things. And Luke had worked in lots of big enterprise businesses, and he'd helped businesses go from no money to lots of money, or, you know, 10x their turnover. He was a really good proactive salesperson, and he taught me some really good tricks that I think you don't see around a lot. So things like contract on a string, which is a way of keeping hold of contracts when you're perhaps at that point of, I've sent a contract, now it's in no man's land. How to follow up, all things about tone, how to ask questions, how to bring social proof into a conversation. So a lot of the things that I use are from what Luke taught me, and they serve me for the rest of my career. He's now a very important man who might not do much selling, but actually when I speak to him, he's always telling me he's jumping on calls. So you might not find much on him. He's not a man who's out there shouting about how great he is, but Luke Dash is definitely someone who you can learn a lot from. Certainly the best boss I ever had, and probably the most influential on my career. So that is it in a nutshell. I mean, we've done almost half an hour there of sales and life questions. The last one to talk about is, and this is more broad, I'm getting a lot of questions on building scripts and people just sending me their scripts and saying, what do you think of this? As great as that is, I know I'd love to go through all of them. I think there's some fundamental rules around building scripts that I would ask people to keep in mind. So if I make a cold call to someone, go back to the point I made earlier, they're in that fight or flight mode. So they're there, they're trying to understand what you're trying to say, but they're in that fight or flight mode. So at that slight increase in cortisol, you're not thinking with all the full faculties of your intellectual mind. So what you want to do based on that is you want to frame your conversation around very simple language. And the way we look at that is, does it pass the pub test? And the pub test is just, could I say that to someone in the pub, friend, stranger, whatever it may be, without them looking at me like I'm an alien? I love to see people call their sales engagement tools things like weapons for pipeline maximization and things like that. I'd love to say we're a optimal partner for people looking to scale their top of funnel outreach. The reality is that just means we book meetings. So I think simplicity is key. So that's number one. Does it pass the simplicity test? Can you water it down to its baseline level of simplicity? The second part of that is, does it use emotional language? So if I was to give you an example in my world, if I said I'm typically invited in by businesses who are struggling to get in front of enough people, well, how do they notice that's a problem? And that's what I added next. Well, I'm invited in by people who are struggling to get enough meetings. As a result, their pipeline looks quite bleak. So that's an emotional context behind the problem existing in the first place. And I do that for all our scripts, every problem, regardless of sector or industry. I want to get it to its most therapized version so the rest of the core can be informed around a problem and a therapized approach. The last thing I want to say on this is you should be avoiding trigger words. So again, my brain, fight or flight mode. I'm already a human being, so I have lots of biases. Biases are, put simply, shortcuts in our brain to allow us to take on large amounts of information and cut straight to a conclusion. It's not always the right conclusion. So what can happen is, I think the example I saw the other day was someone asked me about energy bills. So they would ring up and they would say, I'm typically invited in by people who are struggling with energy bills. That would be the first thing that they said. Now, my brain in fight or flight mode hears energy bills, interrupts, sorry, mate, not interested. The same with other things. There can be cybersecurity sometimes has this, systems. If I'm ringing, let's say I'm selling a system, but I'm speaking to an HR. Well, HR person hears the word system and goes, ah, it's IT you need to speak to. So trigger words are things that would cause someone to come to a conclusion that you're not wanting them to. Could be false, could be preventative. So what I would say instead is you want to remove those. So let's say we use that electricity bill example before. It might be, instead, I'm typically invited in by businesses who are mindful around being more sustainable. And that could be because of a brand awareness piece. They want to be seen like their competitors being very sustainable in hopes it brings them more business. Or perhaps it's not that at all, but they'd be absolutely silly to not want to save money, especially in this economy. But you might tell me you've got too much money as it is, couldn't take on another new client, and you think sustainability is a myth. So yeah, that's it. You want to be avoiding trigger words. Okay, well, look, I've been Zach Thompson. I hope this has been useful. I'm sorry I'm not your favorite one. He is back next week for more trench tips. But until then, Godspeed, and bloody party on, will you?